So, I think everybody knows who I am, Tara Muckles. I'm going to be talking about utilization of services as one of the criteria potentially for selecting topics for comparative effectiveness research. And this, the research that I'll talk about that I did was with a group, Melinda Bucus-Bunton, who's on leave from RAND, Bob Berenson and Stephen Zuckerman, who are based at Urban, project we did a couple years ago that's relevant to this topic. The project was funded by ASPE, and we don't have any conflicts of interest to disclose. So the objectives are just twofold: to discuss issues regarding the use of utilization as cost and cost as criteria for prioritizing comparative effectiveness research, and then to talk about this project that we did with RAND and Urban that can serve as a model potentially for a way of trying to identify services for which additional research would be beneficial because they're growing rapidly and they're used a lot. And then I'm going to look at whether the services that we identified as potential priorities, because they're growing a lot, are things that were also identified by IOM and AHRQ in their priority setting processes. And that's how I'll wrap it up. So, as you may know, there's been a very vigorous debate over the role of costs in comparative effectiveness research. The October issue of Health Affairs has a number of articles, one by our own former clinical scholar Kavita Patel on the whole political process, which was quite interesting and very heated. The first quote is from a New England Journal article from 2009, which sort of summarizes the vision for why people think comparative effectiveness would be helpful in terms of costs, and that it can, you know, enable us to make better spending decisions and achieve better value from our healthcare system. And then the second quote is from Kavita's article. She's quoting Senator Mike Enzi, basically says that the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute that was recently established is just going to be another means of the government dictating which treatments to pay for. And there were a lot of political maneuverings to try to link comparative effectiveness research to rationing of healthcare, basically to try to block progress with the healthcare reform legislation. So this slide, I hope people can read it, summarizes how the different organizations that have been involved in setting priorities for comparative effectiveness research have addressed the question of cost or utilization, or can. So the recently established Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, by according to the legislation, it can't mandate coverage decisions or make specific strong recommendations, and it's also not allowed to use qualies, because quality-adjusted life years were really politically linked to rationing, because they would reduce the value of the lives of people with disabilities and severe illnesses. But nevertheless, CMS, Medicare, is still allowed to, and private payers as well, to use comparative effectiveness research in making coverage decisions. So the main intent of using this type of research to enhance value is preserved by the legislation. And I don't know if anybody knows more that they would like to add about that, but that's what I was able to uncover about the various, you know, different conflicting types of information you'll read about that. The Institute of Medicine, as you know,
I don't think market really include value anymore, and I don't think CMS can really use this to make coverage decisions, other than if the procedure is shown to be of no benefit at all. I mean, the coverage decisions that CMS has to make regarding Medicare is if something's better than a placebo, right now it has to be covered.
Right.
And I don't think the law changed it to say that if a drug is better, it's no better than another drug that costs more, because they can't use cost. So,
right.
So I don't understand what number one means.
The way that it was described is that they can use it within the context of their current decision-making processes. So like you said, if something was proven to be completely ineffective, they could use it as a basis for a coverage decision, but
that's not comparative effectiveness work. You guys are never going to prove somebody to be totally ineffective in this line of work.
Well, I mean, the way Medicare authorizes new services is that they issue, a CPT code is issued, and they pay for it. So, you know, I think it's a good point. I don't know, but that's, they are still allowed to consider comparative effectiveness research. The new, how that'll be operationalized, I don't know. In terms of the other groups, so the Institute of Medicine, as you may know, had a report that came out last year that worked to prioritize clinical topics for comparative effectiveness research. They came out with a list of about 100 different specific clinical topics that they recommended. They put them into quartiles. And they had this process where they really enlisted a variety of different stakeholder groups, including healthcare payers, but there were only, I think, when I saw on the list, 3 different payers that participated in the process. So their involvement wasn't substantial. Didn't seem like they had a major influence over the process. And then after they got input from the stakeholders, then they had sort of a, you know, internal team go through and prioritize the topics. And cost was definitely not a criterion that was considered or utilization in their process. They were really focusing on things that were more common diseases, but not whether services are used frequently or are contributing to cost. Another group, the Federal Coordinating Council for Comparative Effectiveness Research, they have a report that talks about prioritization, but they more talk about how prioritization should happen rather than the specific topics that should be addressed. It's more of a conceptual framework and approach. And they did include cost as one criterion for assessing the potential impact of a particular treatment. AHRQ, they have funded in their CER portfolio the development of overuse and underuse measures, and arguably their mission includes consideration of cost issues. And the VA continues to do some comparative effectiveness research of various types and also to consider both cost and cost effectiveness. But that hasn't really changed. So now, shifting to this project that we did in Rand Urban a couple years ago, we focused on a number of physician services that are that represented a substantial percentage of spending and that were growing rapidly. And it was not the most, the scope of the project was fairly narrow, and our methods had some limitations that will become obvious as we go through it and as I talk about it at the end. But basically, we wanted to investigate potential reasons that different services were growing. And it can be seen as kind of a screening tool for identifying services where there may not be clinical reasons for growth and where additional research or policy changes may be warranted, such as are services overvalued, is there limited research on effectiveness, and where they would be particularly likely, better research would be particularly likely to affect practice and coverage decisions. And that's kind of the link to the comparative effectiveness topic. So this will probably be very familiar to people. Medicare spending has been growing faster than overall spending and represented about 20% of overall spending in 2008. And physician services represent about a quarter of that, and they grew 60% between 2000 and 2005. The motivation for our project had to do partly with the sustainable growth rate policy, and I'm not going to get into that, but we did look at a variety of different types of reasons that services may be increasing in use, and policy interventions may be more effective at limiting growth or allowing growth if they're tailored to the factors contributing to the growth of individual services. So basic reasons that expenditures could be increasing for physician services, obviously population growth, an increasing number of services per beneficiary, an increase in the intensity of services per beneficiary, in other words, more costly services, more RVUs per service, and then price. And it's clear the price was not a factor because fees actually for Medicare declined during this time period in constant dollars. And this is still background information, setting the context for the work we did. What you can see here is that volume and intensity of services really explains the growth in expenditures on physician services. So 60% growth in the size of the population between 2000 and 2005, in the growth in expenditures, 8% growth in the size of the population, 14% growth in volume, and 26% growth in the intensity of the services. So those are much more factors for the big picture. So our specific methods that we used for this project, we looked at services that had high utilization and high growth. So we ranked CPT codes by allowed charges per beneficiary in 2006, and we selected 200. Then we went through those and identified the ones for which allowed charges grew more than 100% between 2000 and 2006. And then we chose 9 diverse groups of services to investigate. And the way we did this was, you know, while our initial screening looked at individual CPT codes, we sort of expanded the CPT codes into families of services that are provided for similar types of clinical indications. So for example, instead of an individual CPT code for a spinal imaging study like a CT scan, we included all spinal imaging studies. And we just had the scope to choose 9 services to investigate. So we focused on those that had higher charges, that grew faster, and where growth wasn't really obviously appropriate. So a couple of things that grew rapidly during this time period were flu shots and DEXA scans. Well, those are pretty much universally recommended for the Medicare population. Well, DEXA, so a little bit more for women, but you know, certainly both of them are widely recommended. So we didn't investigate those services. And we also had to focus on services that for the most part had a fairly limited number of indications. If you have a service like a physician office visit, you're not going to be able to identify specific reasons that physician office visits are growing, as opposed to, say, a CT scan of the spine, where there may be more specific clinical reasons, or, so I'll get into some of the other ones you'll see. So we looked at 2 imaging tests, 2 non-imaging diagnostic tests, 2 surgical procedures, fairly minor surgical procedures, 2 injection procedures, and 1 medical device. And I'll go through each of those and I'll show you what we found. Our choice of diagnostic tests and minor procedures is confirmed, again, by prior research, which showed that, for the most part, imaging tests, non-imaging tests, and minor procedures are growing a lot more than, say, major surgical procedures as physician services in Medicare. And then we looked into potential causes of the growth. And as I said, our methods were, you know, constrained by the scope and the timeline of our project. We did targeted rather than comprehensive literature searches. So we're looking for recent randomized controlled trials, systematic reviews, meta-analyses, major sources of information that are going to change the standard of care. And we also interviewed a number of clinical experts from a variety of different spectrum. So for each service, we interviewed 2 or 3 specialists that either provide the service or are in disciplines where they would refer patients to receive the service. And then we interviewed 1 geriatrician and 1 general internist to get their perspective on what was going on, because you see the sort of the other side of the provision of services. And we gave the interviewees open-ended questions in advance for each of the services that we asked them to comment on. And then we asked them about the potential factors contributing to growth. And this slide summarizes the things that we asked them to consider as potential factors. So clinical factors, we asked them, you know, could epidemiologic trends explain the growth in each service? Or was there some new technology or new evidence in advance in the science that explained potentially the growth in the service? Was there some service diffusion, meaning some factors stimulating patient demand or provider uptake, such as provider marketing activities, market consolidations, things related to the diffusion of the service? Then we looked at financial factors. And some of these are not going to be really easy to say something's in exactly one category versus another category, particularly for service diffusion and financial factors. There's a lot of sort of feedback and interactions between them. And then we looked at financial factors, so RVUs. We got a sense from the experts, did people think that the RVUs were much more, much higher than alternative services that are offered by the same providers or for the same types of patients? And then we looked at Medicare coverage decisions during this time period and how those would have affected utilization of the services.
Can I just ask a
question?
Yeah. In terms of selecting the experts who were interviewed, did you choose them based on their practice environment, you know, whether they were academic or private practice or whatever, and how did you gauge their objectivity beforehand to determine whether they're...
It's a good question. So basically, the way we selected most of our experts was we borrowed from prior RAND panels, you know, the RAND UCLA appropriateness panels that we've had for a variety of different topics. So we contacted people that we knew who had done work in that area and found people from their expert panels. And they go through this pretty detailed process where they approach specialty societies and review CVs. Generally, will interview references, they'll interview the person, so they try to get a sense of where the person's coming from and their position. But you're right, people could have a fairly biased perspective, and you could definitely see that from, you know, some of the interviewees more than others. Some of them had a very strong opinion, oh, people in my field are, you know, turning these tests into profit centers and, you know, marketing them and using them for inappropriate reasons, and others are much more like, you know, they're not paying us enough to pay do this service, they should increase, not decrease the RVU, you know. So you can get a sense talking to people what where they're coming from, but most of the people we interviewed we had used from these prior panels. And they were actually very forthcoming about their opinions. So I don't know if that answers your question, but...
But did they represent sort of different environments?
They did represent different environments, academic versus private practice, different spectrum. And then also, because we included a variety of different specialties, we got different perspectives that way, too. So this is getting into our results. I'm happy to answer more methods questions if people are interested, but just dive in otherwise. So we looked at defibrillators as one of our, the medical device, and basically those between 2000 and 2006 grew by 165%. And from, you know, what's probably clinically obvious to most of you as internists is that there was major change in the standard of care. There's a number of randomized controlled trials, systematic reviews that agree that ICDs reduce all-cause mortality in patients with LV dysfunction and reduce sudden death. It doesn't mean that all of them are used appropriately or every bit of the growth is appropriate. There's certainly plenty we heard from our experts being placed in people who, you know, have limited prognoses and, you know, they end up dying with their defibrillator going off instead of having them turned off when they should be. We also heard about the manufacturer actively marketing to and training cardiologists to put these devices in. What the appropriate role for that is kind of a question, but a side point today. And then another big thing that contributed to the growth during this time period was the Medicare coverage decision. They actually made a specific decision to extend it from people who had a history of sudden death to people who had LV dysfunction. And that was a fairly large population, like 500,000 people. So the next service family that we looked at was these minimally invasive procedures for BPH. Now, I don't know how much people know about these procedures, but you know, the gold standard has been this transurethral resection of the prostate, and there's all these new procedures that use some sort of energy source, and they go through the urethra to open up the prostate. What's that?
Go on.
So like microwave, laser, heat, you can think of, you know, any number of different energy sources. They have a variation on these procedures. And the data on effectiveness is very limited. There's a few randomized controlled trials. None of them go beyond 2 years. And there's a pretty high recurrence rate for some of the procedures, even within the 2-year period. They're also very lucrative for the urologists compared to doing TURP. TURP they do in the hospital. They have fairly low RVUs, even though it's a big procedure and the patient's in the hospital for several days. These are outpatient procedures, so the physician gets the facility portion of the RVUs as well as their own labor RVUs. And again, manufacturers training urologists, setting up equipment, and so forth. There's no coverage decision required because, as Bob and I were discussing, you know, Medicare, basically you have a new CPT code and they start paying. And that's kind of what happened with these. So this is a service where there's a lot of growth, and there are patient preference reasons for growth, such as they're unhappy with the costs and the side effects of medications. And there's marketing or diffusion reasons for growth, but there's not a real evidence for effectiveness that's contributing to growth or supporting growth for this service. Polysomnography. Obviously, obesity is on the rise. Polysomnography is used for sleep apnea, and it has increased more than 400%. There's a couple of financial factors that really appear to contribute as well to the growth in polysomnography. There's a proliferation of sleep labs. Pulmonologists using this as a major sort of profit center. And then until 2008, which is after the time period we were looking at, Medicare actually wouldn't cover CPAP at home unless you had an in-lab sleep study. And they have recently changed that. Now there are these portable devices that are authorized. So bringing this back to the comparative effectiveness topic, there's not really a debate as to whether polysomnography is helpful. There's some recent studies showing that this portable device can replace polysomnography. That's not a big question in the growth of this service. Lumbar-spinal injections, on the other hand, I'm sure many of you are familiar with this particular topic. We looked overall, different types of lumbar-spinal injections grew more than 700%. Epidural injections grew more than 1,000% over a six-year period. Facet injection grew by almost 1,000%, and fluoroscopy by more than 1,200%. 6 years. There's this proliferation of pain clinics, marketing services, and obviously injections are reimbursed way better than dealing with the difficult chronic pain patients and their psychosocial issues. There's limited alternatives, so there's patient factors, but you can see there's the evidence issue does not support the growth. There's very limited evidence for the use of these procedures as opposed to others. So this is an area where comparative effectiveness research could potentially make a big difference in a commonly used service that's growing rapidly and contributing substantially to expenditures.
Charles, yeah. In what condition are you looking at when you say lumbar spinal injections?
Low back pain.
Like acute low back pain or chronic low back pain?
We didn't distinguish those, but we're not... because we're using like very macroscopic data, we had sort of... we didn't distinguish those.
I mean, it's not really acute, I would really say it's subacute versus chronic. I mean, it's those patients who do something and you're trying to hold them off into surgery versus the ones who've had that for years and years and years, and they are psychosocial issues that we just can't address, or behavioral issues.
Well,
so it's just, I'm not sure that studies have been done.
I don't think the data are very good for either of those indications.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, and then another one is Mohs surgery. So in this,
three things that you are trying to understand. The goal is you're going to do a comparative effectiveness study and show that for the category of people, which will be a large percentage of the people on which this is being used, that the stuff has no effectiveness at all. I don't know why you're presenting this. I'm confused.
Okay. So I think that...
So let's take the BPH example. Let's say you show that, stops, improves the symptoms for a week. You can't use dollies or qualities. I mean, what does it matter? Is it really comparative effectiveness you're talking about? Because you keep coming back to no evidence, or is it against a placebo? which is not comparative effectiveness.
Well, for the BPH procedures, there's two alternatives to these minimally invasive procedures. One is the medications that people are already taking, so it doesn't have to be against placebo. And the other is TURP, right?
So
and so
show,
either one of those would advance the degree of knowledge about the appropriateness
no,
of these procedures.
Let's say you come up with a study that shows that the thermal procedure is has a different set of outcomes than the medications.
Yeah.
So what?
I thought what Terrell was doing was trying to suggest a screening procedure that would target clinical topics that might benefit from more comparative effectiveness research. Is that what you're doing?
Yes.
That's what I thought the task was.
Yeah, when you talk about it, the way you look at you're presenting the utilization data is it screening more than utilization data? Or, I mean, you started out with two quotes. One was the quote that it's got its bureaucracy. The other quote is it's going to contain cost. Neither which is what this is all supposed to be about. This is all supposed to be about giving some information. I mean, the way they got this through is to give information to people about what... As
well,
the doctors, that was the whole way they, I mean, Carol Clancy, when she talks about this subject, stays away from both of those topics like they're, pariahs.
They're very politically heated topics, whether or not cost should be considered. But regardless, if a procedure is being done frequently, you can make a cost argument for why you need better data as to whether it's effective, and you can also make a clinical argument, right? So if they're doing BPH to procedures on hundreds of thousands of men, we should have some data as to whether it's really better than the medications that they're foregoing.
Let's say you did have that data.
Right.
You think it would change anything?
Because of the
Well, just because, I mean, the story you tell on every one of these is someone does a piece of research which may be real or may be fraudulent, and then a marketing company takes that piece of research and uses it to say, here's a piece that we wave in the face to say that this works, and now we can go and sell it, whatever it is. And it may have zero benefit, or it may have some marginally small benefit, which is probably not, which is, does not justify its cost. But it gets adopted because there are all kinds of people, both companies and individuals, who have financial incentives to do it. And that's the story over and over again. And it doesn't seem to me that another piece of research is going to kind of roll back the clock. I mean, I just don't see the research as being the solution to this problem, which, as you said, is fundamentally political.
Isn't one of the possibilities that CMS uses this information not necessarily to determine coverage, but to determine the reimbursement rate? And so if they say, okay, that's fine, we're going to continue to cover procedure X, even though it's only marginally more effective than procedure Y, but you're only going to make $5 from the injection. So we
of course, you know
what the cost is, and this is how we're going to pay you for it.
Well, if someone lets Don Berwick do that, he'd probably do it. But the fact is that I suspect that political forces will take and tie both of his hands behind his back, and he'll be unable to do anything like that because it's not in the interest of people in power.
And that seems like the value of this is to be able to actually present the information and say, if we can take it and show, if we were to only marginally reimburse by this much more, then we're going to stop getting unnecessary procedures provided. And so the numerical data has some value. I mean, it may not be successful, I totally agree with you politically, but it may be useful to try to make the argument.
To me,
so are you going to pay, let's take coronary bypass surgery, are you going to pay the cardiologist bypass surgeon more money if he operates on somebody with left main disease than with three-vessel disease with reduced injection fraction than with three-vessel disease without injection fraction? So given the value, are you going to pay the person, let's say where you have really good data now, presumably, or at least as good data as we're ever going to get, are you going to pay him when he operates on the left main disease patient $40,000? And when he operates on the three-vessel disease where there's probably no evidence that it increases life expectancy with an increase injection fraction, you're going to pay him with a normal injection fraction, you're going to pay him $5,000. Is that the goal of what this is about? I mean, because if you're going to use this to screen something, I think you really do need to know the answer, of how it's going to be used. Because you want to put the comparative effectiveness money into those places, which are the increased likelihood to make a clinical change which requires uptake and use. And I'm really confused now about, I mean, I understand it. I mean, you can go through the data and you don't have to show the time trend. You can just go through the data. That's what we did with the appropriateness stuff. We took all of the surgical procedures, we lumped them together in homogeneous groups, and we said, let's try to cover the ones that are most costly, that we spend more, most money, not most individually costly, we spend most money on. Let's start there. That's where we start, that's how we started the, it was called the Health Services Utilization Study. That's how we started. Now, nobody looked at that when the IOM didn't even run something like that when they tried to figure out what to begin with.
No.
They had no concept of how often atrial fib is treated by one way or the other.
Well, my understanding is that they looked at how common the conditions are and how interested people were in having these solutions address the different stakeholder groups. I don't think they looked at utilization. And actually, I happened to be talking to one of the IOM staff members who worked on that report around the time that they were working on it, because we were doing another project together, and she had told me that they had not considered utilization as an issue at all.
So somebody had decided that they were really interested in removing a green nodule on the left toe and comparing whether if you use a surgeon or burn it off, they would have gone ahead and do it. There was no concept about cost or use at all. Or how big of a problem it represented?
They looked at, like, for example, they would choose conditions that were common, like alcohol abuse or atrial fibrillation or those types of things, but they didn't have any screening within that, or even overall seeing whether utilization was high or expenditures were high. They didn't look at that.
Do we know why? It can't be that dumb.
Maybe because it was so politically heated. They just sidestepped it completely. I don't know, I don't know who it was. I think.
Have you ever talked to that person?
No, I just talked to the staff member.
Might be useful.
Yeah.
You did it really fast, too.
It was very fast. It was like a 4-month project or something.
Yeah, it takes 1 minute. I mean, that's the simplest thing to get is the frequency data of all this stuff.
Yeah. All right. So Mohs surgery is another topic. So Mohs grew by more than 150%. Very limited data on effectiveness. Actually, the Mohs surgery, there have been a number of case series. There's like a systematic review of case series, if that isn't the biggest oxymoron you've ever heard. That is the reason that the procedure is widely used and touted as effective for non-melanomatous types of skin cancer. There was a randomized controlled trial published just a couple of years ago the only randomized controlled trial to date published just a couple of years ago that found no benefit over a wide excision, which is much less expensive. And there has been no subsequent research to address this clinical question. So growing really rapidly, much more than wide excision is for skin cancer. Obviously, skin cancer is growing, but there's this other issue of, you know, which is the better therapy, the wide excision or the Mohs surgery. And there's other types of interventions for certain skin cancers that are not surgically based as well.
So if you had a squamous cell based on that, you would have just a wide excision?
Because you wonder what the outcome was, maybe beyond cost, you can have a wide excision.
So it's a randomized controlled trial comparing wide excision to Mohs surgery.
And what outcome?
I believe it was recurrence rates at 5 years.
But what I'm saying is that a valued outcome is cosmesis. And, you know, if it's on somebody's face,
I think most of them are. Right, and that's where the advantage of Mohs purportedly is. And I think that they looked at that in the randomized control trial, and there was not a significant difference between the cosmetic outcomes either.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I could pull the study if you want, but they did look at that. And then, there in our evaluation, it really sounded, talking to different people, like there was a number of financial factors contributing to the growth of Mohs more than that there was a big increase in skin cancer. And Medicare actually reduced reimbursement for Mohs in 2008 after the study period. Electrodiagnostic tests. This was a harder one to study because there's such a variety of different indications for electrodiagnostic tests, and we were looking at kind of broad categories. We looked at the different types of diagnoses that were associated with the use of electrodiagnostic tests, and we saw virtually identical distributions of the types of diagnoses in 2000 versus 2006. But what we heard from talking to the different experts was that there's this proliferation of pain in spine centers that are doing the spinal injection procedures. The orthopedists are doing spine surgery, which we didn't look at. And that these are often part of the routine workup in these centers. There's also some reports of increasing use of these portable tests by non-specialists. Primary care doctors allegedly are using them to recover some of the lost income because of the declining E&M reimbursement. And Medicare actually pays the same for the portable studies.
So the opposite is true. They reduced the mammogram payment rate so much for screening mammograms that you can't get a mammogram in LA. It's really hard in many parts of LA to get a schedule. So Cedars, I talked to the CEO, so Cedars is buying more mammogram machines, not because there aren't enough mammogram machines in this city, but because radiologists are reimbursed so poorly that they prefer to do other things. And there's no question you can drive, and so the question is, if you, what do you do? I mean, it really is. There's
right.
No question.
Yeah, that it makes a difference. Ophthalmic injections for macular degeneration. People are probably familiar with this story as well. So the vascular endothelial growth factors. There was, in 2004, the FDA approved these, and they're shown in randomized controlled trials to be very effective for macular degeneration, certain types of macular degeneration. And so you get this rapid dissemination of this new therapy that, in this case, seems to be driven by evidence.
Actually not. It's true. I was on the committee that dealt with that coverage decision. And unfortunately, it's driven by, the ophthalmologists can't even recognize macular degeneration. There's a very small part of macular degeneration is classical. And everything else is what I call unreliable. And what has really happened is now everyone under the sun, I mean, just think about the procedure of sticking something in your eyeball, just multiple times, and it's all based on somebody looking in your eye and seeing something that is not, I mean, the classical part is easy. It was the whole expansion to the non-classical sort of macular degeneration. I spent more time talking to ophthalmologists about the basics of reliability, and they, you know, when we were talking to them in the meeting, it was just awful about what's happened because the drug, I mean, at least the way they were reimbursing it. And then there's the question of which drug to use.
Right.
And that's all another political one. As well.
Right. Yep.
The difference in cost is amazing.
It is amazing. And I've heard a lot of ophthalmologists are actually using the less expensive one off-label.
Yep.
Even though they get paid less. So the last service that we looked at was CT MRI of the lumbar spine. And I think everybody knows that early imaging is of no value for lumbar spine. And nevertheless, it's almost doubled in the time period we looked at. And there's a bunch of financial factors that, again, are people that we interviewed identified. And there's also a number of articles covering this literature as well, which is basically these legal ways of circumventing the Stark rules so that particularly primary care doctors, but also these spine and pain injection centers can own their own machine and kind of, well, not own them, but like rent them on a per service basis. And this was confirmed by some digging we did into the Medicare database that we had, where a lot of the utilization, the increase in billing was not by radiologists, but rather by other types of providers. Oh, wait, actually there's one more. This is the last one. So cardiac stress tests. These, when you look at them as a...
Can I just ask something?
Yeah.
So did you find evidence that there's an increase in ordering of those studies amongst primary care physicians and the spine physicians, even when they didn't have ownership, or even when they weren't renting the machines?
Well, the data
was... Was it the ordering or the owning or, you know, renting the machine that was driving it in your analysis? You know?
So the different types of information that we used were sort of readily available, you know, publications on the subject, as well as looking at the Medicare database. So what we did was we just looked at what the distribution of specialties ordering the test was in 2000 versus 2006. There was a very small increase in this is for who bills for the procedure, in radiologists billing for the procedure. There was a much larger increase in billing by other types of providers, which are harder to identify. They're kind of more lumped together, but they're going to be primary care people and the various other types of specialists.
At UCLA, when I had my prostate removed, I had to sign a waiver that I would not, that I did not want a cardiac workup. That's the policy at UCLA. And it's not, I mean, the policy was that if you're an old fart, no matter whether you have symptoms or not, or somebody can physically examine your heart or not, which is irrelevant, you have to sign a waiver that you did not want a cardiac evaluation.
And when you said no, you needed a psychiatric consult.
Yeah, but there's no psychiatrists around my plan at UCLA since they don't accept my plan, so the bottom line, they couldn't find one to do that.
That's funny.
I said, why would I want a cardiac exam? I mean, a cardiac evaluation. And, you know, they basically said, you know, that's the standard of practice here. Mm-hmm. Not an EKG, a cardiac evaluation. For some reason, I had a normal EKG. I don't know why, but the bottom line is that it couldn't even, it was read, it wasn't even read as anything abnormal, totally normal. And then the next response was, you need a cardiac evaluation.
Doesn't it strike you as odd that only the cardiologists get that benefit? I mean, why did they ask you, do you want a neuro eval? Do you want a pulmonary eval? Do you want your poop examined? You know, I mean, the gastroenterologists are really losing out here.
Well, I guess just remember that all colonoscopies in the UK are done by nurses. No gastroenterologist does a routine screening colonoscopy. It's all done by nurses in the UK. Somebody has to do a cross-effectiveness study and show that they spend more time in actually finding polyp in the right colon. That's because, as opposed to gastroenterologists here who don't, because they have to do them in 3.5 minutes. But I'm still a little bit lost on all of this. The goal here is that I understand the increased use, I understand what's going on. You think you can target the comparative effectiveness agenda to change all this? Beyond what you are. I mean,
I think you articulated yourself a few minutes ago where the point of the whole talk, which is that utilization should at least be on the radar when you're choosing topics for comparative effectiveness research. The fact that it's not is shocking.
And so,
it's not just a cost argument. You know,
so
if you're using the service
IOM,
a lot, you should know if it works.
Let me flip the question around. If you look at the IOM list and just show how silly it was because it doesn't contain any cost or utilization. I mean, that's what ought to be done, that it contains such a small part of the budget that if even, did you do that?
This is what I did, because the original purpose of this project was not to tackle the cost, the comparative effectiveness question. So what I did do is look at, and this is what I just did today, look at our topics that we identified as high growth, high utilization services. And I've got the growth there, and the evidence, this is just the summary, you know, based on what we found, scoping it out. The ones where it's very limited are in yellow, and you can see that the IOM has targeted 2 of these. And then in terms of AHRQ, I looked at the list of actual awards that they had on their website. You know, they probably have another bunch of things in the pipeline. But in terms of actual awards, they addressed 1, so the spine, basically.
And a defibrillator.
They also addressed the defibrillator, but the defibrillator, you know, there's quite a bit more evidence there. I'm not saying it shouldn't be looked at more, but there's quite a bit more evidence for defibrillators than there is for these BPH procedures, for example.
It'd be interesting if somebody could actually write out the whole train of events, that this is what would have to happen, this is who would have to do something different, and this would be the expected change, and the health and cost actually follow this all out. I mean, that'd be very easy to do, to say, here's the question to be funded, how long is it going to take, what people are going to do, and then what would have to happen to do with it. So let's take the spinal injection one. What do you think ought to be done? I mean, you've looked at this now. What ought to be done? What should, if you were in charge, if you were the comparative effectiveness czar, what would you do?
Well, I think I would focus on the individual procedures that we lumped together, and probably each of those would need to be compared with an alternative, which could be something like, you know, conservative management, watchful waiting, return to usual activities as quickly as possible, those types of things. You could also have an arm looking at surgery. Three different arms, I suppose.
A randomized trial is what you're talking about?
No, like, you know, comparing the three different...
In an administrative database? I mean, I really think it is absolutely critical for the things that you picked up to actually indicate what you're a doc, what you would find to be convincing evidence to change your behavior or to change the behavior of the docs that you think are being out to lunch. I mean, you can pick two consumer groups, docs, or you can pick patients. But it would be fascinating to know what would you fund if you had to decide to fund it. How much money would it be worth to answer the question? I mean, how much money would you spend getting an answer to a question of the things that you dealt with, and how would you do it?
Right, so what's your ROI for your investment in the research, is kind of what you're saying.
Or just your thought process if you don't want to do an ROI. I'm more comfortable in trying to figure out, I didn't say you had to figure out what the impact change would be, I'm just trying to figure out how you put this all together in terms of what's going on.
How do I put it all together?
So the example, if you take the simplest thing about back surgery, chiropractic care, we know absolutely, here's something that's effective. We know absolutely nothing about the frequency of chiropractic care. I mean, how would you tackle that problem, or unless you decide not to cover chiropractic care?
It's not hard to find out about the frequency of chiropractic care. In certain databases, like the Medicare database, it's quite easy. You just find the CPT codes.
Yeah, but you know nothing about the outcome.
I guess I misunderstood your question.
If you were going to take the comparative effectiveness initiative on anything, like let's say you have back pain and you get physical therapy, or any of the small stuff, not the street one operation, anything that involves frequency, which is a lot of what you're talking about, how would you actually construct an analysis to answer the question? So I met on the plane the chairman of pediatrics when he came back from the clinical scholar meeting. She goes to exercises funded by her group, her HMO, to teach her how to increase muscle mass. Exercises, not a gym that she pays on her own. Exercises so that she can lift her suitcase and put it in the overhead compartment when she's 75 as opposed to 68. That's her goal. And she goes religiously every week, and they have a plan, and the plan pays for it. My mother-in-law goes to Kaiser every week to do balance exercises. Every week, forever. They pay for it. Some people buy their own massages, as opposed to, but there's increasingly this whole stuff of junk that's being thrown out there. And you've got a large part of it in your database. How do you design a comparative effectiveness agenda to actually decide what you want to pay for?
I thought we were talking just a few minutes ago about how it's hard to use it to determine what to pay for.
Well, I mean, even if you could, somebody said they were going to do it for value, or help. Do you think we ought to, I mean, I'm just really trying to figure some of this out. are we ever going to do this before we have really detailed clinical databases? Are we going to do this observational data, or what? How would you, if you really were, you know as much as anyone in the country now, if you were in charge of this agency, if Eugene Washington called you up, asked you how to do this, or you were on the methodology committee, what are people going to say? What would you tell them?
Well, I think it seems like the outcome, measuring outcomes well, is probably one of the more challenging aspects of this. It's easy to find out whether people had a procedure or a certain type of treatment in a lot of cases, but measuring outcomes is going to be more challenging.
No, I understand that, but I'm not asking what the problem is. I'm asking what the solution is. I mean, somebody says to you, you've got to write a memo to the president with a solution. Not a problem. You don't have a problem, you lose your job. If Anish can't answer the question for the president or for he gets fired, I mean, they'll turn to an economist. You're a clinician. What if you really look at all the stuff you've done an enormous amount of thinking here, how do you tie this to, even if you had a place to do policy or to affect, well, how do you really deal with this?
You mean where are the policy levers?
So I'm now reading the journals. What is the, in this head-to-head comparison of A to B, the way they concluded is B, the way they're concluding this is B is no more, was proven to be no more beneficial than A. Because the confidence limits, they never say that B may not be, could be still better than A, but in this study, B was never proved to be better than A. Now, not a single doctor that reads that understands that. I mean, maybe three clinical scholars and two fellows understand that, but most people couldn't understand what the hell that means. But it's fascinating how they've made them use the language. They've changed, that's the correct way of using the language. Now, what do you do with that if you read that? What do you, I mean, is that which, I mean, are we going to do observational studies and say, you know, 20 chiropractic visits did not result in people going back to work earlier or suffering? And 5 or 10 or 1, even if we could, you were going to have to randomize people, what are we going to do with all this stuff?
Probably depends on your specific clinical question you're trying to tackle and the quality and nature of the available data relating to that question.
I understand that. I'm just trying to, I understand all that. I'm trying to flip it around and get you to answer.
So, like, what are you going to do?
Instead
where
of
the
asking me a question. So take
where are the policy levers?
Take UCLA's policy of a cardiac workup.
Well, that's a CYA thing.
A what?
CYA.
Cover your ass.
They don't want to get sued if you code on the table.
The anesthesiologists have decided, we can't, everyone's kind of either overtly or covertly decided that we limit our liability, we may generate some revenue, and it's an easy thing to enforce, and it's in the name of eliminating variability. So that if you had a good internist who said, you know, you're okay to have anesthesia, you're lucky, but you might not have such a good internist, and maybe the cardiologist would bail the internist out.
So you wouldn't include that in the comparative effectiveness check?
What's that?
You wouldn't include taking
I would love to, but I mean, I am completely pessimistic that any of this makes any difference at all. I think we have to get poor enough. The political forces change the system, and you can do anything. You can do the most brilliant piece of research, the most shoddy piece of research, and it makes absolutely no difference.
I think that the question for the TERP situation has already been addressed by the guidelines. I mean, it's not like, I don't even think it would be an intermediate risk procedure. So why would you need cardiac stress testing ever? That's already been addressed.
Well, so we know that you don't need imaging and back pain. You know, the AHCPR before AHRQ guideline did that 18 years ago. It doesn't make a difference. I mean, the guidelines say don't do it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a question of evidence. I guess my
a lot
question
of times
is,
it's not, right.
And you mentioned this earlier, I'd be curious what Bob said about this too, which is politicians have this supposition that the public is not ready for rationing. Is there market research or any kind of evidence to suggest that isn't an invention of the politicians? Because when I talk to people, not people who are wealthy, but people who are in rank and file, they're rationing all the time, they have no problem with that concept. When we run away from this idea of rationing as if it's some horrible thing, and any politician who mentions it is going to be immediately cast out of office. And I don't know what the evidence is for that.
Well, I'm going to teach a course in the spring session, which I call Value of Healthcare and Change of Inequality. And the end product of the course has to be three memos. One written to the president about what to do, one written to Clancy about what to do with the research community. I forgot who, but one written to CEO of a healthcare organization about what to do. If you don't write an answer to the question of what to do, what's the next step, nobody passes. Maybe what will happen. But the bottom line is there. I want people. People have to be. I mean, people have to. You know, what do we really suggest ought to be done? And the answer could be that, you know,
stop paying for anything.
No. Well, George Lumbrough, who was the president, I wrote this thing in JAMA to change quality and value. So the response I got from most people, most docs, was screw it. Just make the patient pay everything, and therefore it's not our job. Then there was George Lumbrough that answered the exact way you did, which said, Bob, great article, I liked it, it's right on, but I fear that until we become substantial poor, nobody will care, because this is only about money. Nothing you suggested there is probably actually more harmful than, I mean, it was very close to prove that it's harmful, as opposed to just waste. And so that's so how do you deal with waste with a comparative effectiveness agenda? That's the real question. So the example I come up with is the modeling work on hysterectomy, which shows that if you remove a uterus from any woman who says they don't want to get pregnant anymore, you increase their life expectancy by 4 days. Now, if I can't use cost,
you're done.
I'm done. And do I need to do comparative effectiveness work to prove that, to say, okay, the 3 days is now 2.5 days. And I would have to do a hell of a lot of, you know, a randomized trial that's just unbelievable. I mean, what I really don't understand here is whether it is, we are just not going to pay. I mean, I think the people that are talking about value are really basically saying what David says is that, you know, we ought to pay for very, very little. We ought to pay very little for things that are not so valuable. If we can figure out how to do that.
Well, what about an RVU multiplier? What about, like, you know, if we haven't studied it, it gets a 1. If we study it and it looks like it's low value, we multiply by 0.9 or 0.8 or whatever, you know. So if left main disease has got a different CPT code, then, you know.
So practice will migrate to whatever things fall out of your system as being the most lucrative.
Well, they'll try. So what you'll say is that, so UCLA refused to put in cochlear. It's the only thing at this tertiary hospital partner never did. So for kids that needed a cochlear implant, they refused to develop a service for it. And the reason for that was the DRG that the implant fell into didn't even cover the cost of the implant. And they said, we're not into the game to do that. And you want us to put an implant in, we need to make money. We're certainly not going to do it for altruistic reasons. I'm all for that, but is that what we think we're driving to? And does any of this kind of research at the margin help decide the crudeness of the reimbursement system? So what I'm really asking is, what could I discover from work on macular degeneration or on, you know, cardiac stress tests that would change what I would do right now? What would I have to do to change some policy, is what I'm really asking. And are there things on that list that are more likely to find for research to change that policy than for other things? So it's not only utilization, but it's something else that has to be multiplied by this. I don't know. I don't know the answer. If you talk to the UK docs about how they deal with the budget, they just shake their head at you. Have you seen the little cartoon between, look up orthopedic surgeon and anesthesiologist. Have you seen the cartoon on YouTube? Have you seen it? It's great. I mean,
I need to fix it.
What? Orthopedic surgeon talking about a patient with a fracture, into an anesthesiologist, you know, I have a fracture, not a patient, I have a fracture, need to fix it. And, you know, and it's just the funniest thing under the sun.
I think that...
It sounds funny.
Going back to the health insurance experiment, what we almost need to do is redo that. Not disease by disease, but say, we're going to randomize people again to low-tech, high-human contact care or all this stuff, you know, for-profit, do as much procedures as you can, make as much money, and do it with 10,000 people and measure outcomes and show that globally that it's a philosophy that's fundamentally wrong and doesn't produce any of the results at this cost. Rather than doing it, well, you know, they injected this person and they shouldn't have been injected, but this one could have. I don't think you're ever going to get anywhere that way. I think we need to repeat the health insurance experiment in terms of a complete style of healthcare.
Sort of like the medical home type of thing?
You could design however you want, but you need to show that, you know, Kaiser treating 10,000 people this way, and the fee-for-service sort of all the stuff that you demonstrate is going on right here, doing, you know, acting in a free market way this way, and then you count the bodies at the end, and you count the quality of life of those people, and you count how much it costs, and you show that for 10% of the cost, you achieve the equivalent outcomes, which is, I'm sure, what the study would find. One more big experiment in it? I think that's a study.
So I can tell you my elderly couple sex joke. So,
of course you can, Bob.
Do we have to laugh?
It's a great. My mother told it to me when she was about 88. It's this elderly couple goes, and you probably heard of it, goes to their primary care doctor, and they sit down in front and say, look, we're really worried that if we have sex, we're going to die. And the family doctor is really great, says to them, okay, I don't know how to deal with this problem, but why don't you go have sex? I'll do an EKG. If I don't see anything bad, you know, we'll do it. So they go to the room in the office, they have sex, they get the EKG, we go home. Come back next week with the same story. Doctor does the same thing because, you know, okay, twice. I mean, then comes back the third time, so then they say, so he finally says, okay, I got to talk to you. So what's this all about? So the woman says, well, you know, my husband is home in my house. And the man says that my wife's home in my house. And that you charge us $100 for doing this. The Holiday Inn charges only 80, but Medicare picks up 80% of your bill.
That's funny.
Well, I mean, it is the question of what, I mean, when you start getting into all of these, I mean, look, when you start getting into all of this physical therapy, all of these kinds of stuff, it's the upfront knowledge is that it's, well, all of us, is that it's a pretty low benefit activity. I just wonder whether research is good enough to make it that such an improbable benefit that we will say we're not going to pay for it or do something, not going to do it. So as you think through every time, so you saw the Mohs surgery data, which you, as a doc, I'm presuming you're seeing patients as a doc, somebody had a squamous cell lesion on their face, would you send it to a Mohs surgeon or a regular, somebody that didn't do Mohs surgery?
Well, I think that's generally one of the big factors that determines which surgery people get. You know, do you know a Mohs surgeon or do you just know a plastic surgeon? You know, who do you know determines which one you get. That's a big factor. Who would I send it to?
I don't treat cancer.
Does
anyone at this site do anything with skin cancer other than Mohs surgery? I mean, I don't really believe so anymore.
No, but we have very active Mohs surgeons here, actually. There's
Absolutely.
Only a small number of Mohs surgeons in the country, and the guy that we have here is one of the national leaders.
My mother, when she was, I didn't even, and my mother in Tucson, when she was 90-something, said, you know, we got a, the comments were made, and again, I don't know whether it's true or not, the comments were made, you know, I want to take out the smallest amount to get the tumor. It's not because of cosmetic on the face, I mean, maybe it's slightly different, but want to do it so it has a higher chance of healing, and be a small union, and maybe there is a randomized trial in an 85-year-old, but the general belief structure is that if it's one half the size, that it would be if you just did a Y decision that it's likely to be better. Maybe that's wrong.
Yeah, I think that's what one of the things that they looked at in that randomized trial is that the size of the wound didn't end up being that much different between just cutting it out and doing this whole fancy looking at the margins thing.
People come into my ER with nonsense, little kids with nonsense cuts. People want a plastic surgeon. You know, West Side people.
Well, that's a whole different
with zero evidence that the outcome is going to be the same. There's good evidence that the outcome will be indistinguishable, you know, any period of time down the road. Insurance pays for
it. Well, thank you for a very lively discussion.
Thank you.
Well, we have a manuscript that we've been working on. It's been to a few places because we had, you know, fairly limited methods. It's been to a few places, and now it's at like some journal that I can't even remember the name, the American Journal of Managed Care or something like that.
All right.
You know Bob Aronson, don't you? You do, right?
I do, yeah.
Yeah. He's an interesting guy.
On that.